Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Never mind raising cool kids, plugged-in kids, hip kids. My guest today wants just the opposite, uncool kids, unplugged, unhip. She wants to raise geeks and says you should too. And here's how she defines geeks: genuine, enthusiastic, empowered kids. It's time to turn away, she says, from a culture of cool. So what if the kids don't have a cell phone until high school? Who cares if they're popular, a boyfriend or girlfriend for your tween? Forget it. Geeks, she says, is the new cool. This hour, On Point, bringing up kids not to be cool, but to be good and grounded. Joining me in the studio is Mary Beth Hicks. She's family columnist for the Washington Times, mother of four, and author of the new book, Bringing Up Geeks. That is, genuine, enthusiastic, empowered kids, how to protect your kids' childhood in a grow-up-too-fast world. Mary Beth Hicks, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
So what's this culture of cool that's got you really unhappy?
Okay, well, the culture of cool is a media-saturated, consumer- and materialist-driven state of pseudo-adulthood, where our kids have very short periods of time to enjoy an innocent, wholesome childhood before they're labeled tweens, which now is, due to age creeping, is down to about 8 to 13. And from about that age, they're very involved in the culture in ways that kind of exploit and corrupt their innocence in many ways.
With what consequences? What do you mean corrupt their innocence? What do you mean exploit?
What I mean is that kids today are engaging in kind of this state of pseudo-adulthood, I said, where they're very involved in instant messaging, very engaged in the computer and in social networking sites, kind of doing things that are accelerating their growing up process. So there's almost nothing to look forward to. I have a 10-year-old daughter who thinks that if she keeps begging, we'll get her a cell phone, and it's not happening until high school for her. I don't really want her to have everything now right away. I want her to have to look forward to some things, and in the meantime, to enjoy the innocence and play of childhood that you really kind of have to give up as you grow up.
So what are you talking about there? You've got kids 18, 16, 14, 10. Mm-hmm. It looks to me like you've got, what, three girls and a boy.
Correct.
Are you talking about Little House on the Prairie? Can you really have that back? Is that what you envision?
Do you know kids can still read the Little House on the Prairie series, and mine have, and they loved it. Yes, exactly.
I don't mean just reading it. I mean living it.
Is
that your vision?
No. And we're completely, I mean, we are a normal family in every way. We have more than one television. We have computers. My kids have iPods. I'm not talking about becoming a hermit. I am talking about, though, regulating and controlling some of the influence of pop culture in the lives of our kids so that it's our values that are driving our decisions for our children and not just what everyone else is doing or what the media is telling our children they should be doing to be happy.
Give us a sense of what that means in your household or what you're recommending would be. We'll talk about what's the let's not do that. What's off limits then in your vision here?
A great example. When my oldest daughter, Kate, who's now 18, when she was 13 or about 12 or so, everybody started to get a screen name and they all wanted to instant message. Well, this was new to us because this was our oldest daughter. So we said, well, what would instant messaging look like? How would you spend your time? What would that be? And she said, well, I'll come home after school and I'll get on the computer and I'll talk to my friends. And I said, well, what about reading books and playing outside? And can't you just call your friends on the phone or ride your bike down there and play with your friends? Well, no, we want to sit on the computer and talk to friends. Mm-hmm. So my husband and I discussed it and we thought, you know, this is just not how we value spending our time. This isn't valuable to us. So no, we'll pass on that. Well, little did we know that would be, you know, a huge impact on her social life in some ways. Now, she still had wonderful friends and she was able to engage them, but she was one of the few who was not online.
And this is Kate, who's 18
now.
She's
18 now.
So she went right through the heart of the IMing mania, instant messaging. I mean, everybody was doing it.
Right.
If you weren't in there, you weren't in, or was she? Did you come off looking like tyrants? Did you condemn her to being, an outsider looking in or something else?
You know, she survived beautifully with a wonderful network of friends, and she, lived through that pre-adolescent time in a very happy way. She just didn't participate in that. And yes, there were times when it probably was difficult for her, and I know it was, but she still accepted that these were the rules we had in our house because it was just not something that reflected the way we value spending our time. And as our children have gotten older, now the two older daughters, instant message usually to talk to each other when the oldest one's away at college. But it's something we still don't do for the younger two because it's just not something we value about the way we want to spend our time. So that's really what I'm talking about, is making sure that whatever decision we make on behalf of our children, it's always a reflection of what we personally value about time or money or the way our children are behaving. We just want it to be reflective of what's really important to us.
Paint a picture for us of what you fear happens with kids if you don't put these kind of boundaries around them these days. What's the kind of, I don't know, characterization or caricature, whichever way you like, Mary Beth, of the sort of problem life, the young life that you don't like the texture of.
Okay. I remember reading a story once in the New York Times about a mother who was kind of dismayed because her daughter, who was at that time, I want to say 9 or 10, was waking up early in the morning before school at about 5:30 or 6 in the morning, 2 hours before she needed to be up, so that she could IM her friends before school. Mm-hmm. And she had been doing that until probably 10 o'clock the night before. And so really it becomes this obsessive behavior where kids sort of feel like they have to be on, they're going to miss something. They have, you know, fear of missing out. And, you know, it really, when it dictates their lives in such a way that it's becoming the exclusive way they spend their time to the exclusion of other healthy things you could be doing as a child, then I think it takes over and it's just not healthy and appropriate.
So instant messaging off the table in your blueprint here. What else?
Well, we are one of the few who regulate the notion of having a cell phone until later. It's true that my 10-year-old daughter, who will be in the sixth grade in the fall, is one of the few among her closest friends who has no cell phone. And I know where she is all the time. We always arrange our
rides
in
advance. Because her friends have cell phones to let you know?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, it's not needed for us to assure her safety, and it's not needed for her to communicate with her friends. We have a house phone. She's welcome to use it anytime she wants. And, you know, so it's not that we necessarily won't let her communicate with her friends, that's ridiculous. But we just don't need a 10-year-old who's sitting there on text messaging all day.
How old then? 11, 12, 13, 14? When does the cell phone hit the hand of your child?
My children get a cell phone in the summer before freshman year in high school. Because in high school we expect that they'll have more freedom and more autonomy, and so they'll need to be able to communicate.
I am off. Cell phone's off. So far, it's all technology. What else is off the table here in this geek wonderland?
I suppose the third thing that we do more diligently, I suppose, than other folks are, is that we're really trying to monitor the material that comes through our home in terms of media, in terms of content. And so, you know, it's making sure that the websites and the television shows and the movies reflect our values, are things that we feel are wholesome and appropriate and, you know, are really good for kids. We don't necessarily, you know, that doesn't mean our kids are living in a bubble. As I said, I mean,
You didn't throw out the TV, did you?
No, heavens no. No, no, no. In fact, we have cable because that's the only way I can get Food Network. Okay, so you know, we have media available to us, but our children recognize that it's not freewheeling. You know, there are things we view as just inappropriate or not beneficial to us, so we just choose not to enjoy them.
And where do you draw the line there? Peter Pan's okay. What's not?
You know, it's just not that simplistic, and it's certainly not that unsophisticated. History Channel is great. We're way into the History Channel. We love TLC. We love programming that, you know, uplifts us and doesn't insult our intelligence. What's not great is episodes of The Office for a 10-year-old, okay? The Office is a fun, great show, and I enjoy it with my older teenagers. It's an interesting show, but it's well-written and it's great. But it's not appropriate for a 10-year-old, and you'd be amazed at the number of children who are 10 and 11 years old who are watching programming that is meant for adults. So it's a question of making sure that parents are monitoring and supervising such that kids are watching things that are made for kids, and the older children and adults are watching things that are designed for them. And you can't do that if you've got a television in the bedroom because kids are watching whatever they want. So we don't do that. We don't have televisions in the bedroom.
Dating or the path to dating, what do you say?
Well, one of the avenues to raising a geek in the book is to raise a late bloomer. And so while we can't necessarily control the advent of development and Mother Nature takes her course when she does, we're not in any rush to pair off. We're not into dating in middle school and certainly in high school. We're open to dating in a way that's, you know, wholesome again and appropriate, where kids are going to school functions or having fun with their friends. They're with groups of both genders and they have a great time. But, you know, we're not necessarily a no you know, the notion of this hookup culture for teenagers is dangerous, and it can hurt their hearts and souls and hurt them physically. And so we're saying, what's the rush? You know, there's plenty of time in life for relationships that are romantic and exclusive, and it's certainly not necessary as a middle schooler and not even as a high schooler if you're not inclined. And so, you know, I mean, I'm amazed at the parents who think it's normal, appropriate, and wanted for their kids to be dating in middle school. And it's just, and I think that's how we open ourselves to all kinds of risks.
We'll talk about what your kids make of this. What about other parents? I mean, you live in central Michigan. Mm-hmm. Do they think, I mean, I'm sure you've got readers who follow this and are mm-hmm. all for it. I mean, you've got your clan in a way there. Mm-hmm. But what about just, you know, folks in the neighborhood who think, oh, that Mary Beth, she's like on a crusade all the time to, you know, or are they on board? Or do they share your concern?
I am amazed at the number of people who are coming up to me and saying, both in my hometown and as I travel around speaking to parent groups, oh, thank goodness I thought I was all alone. I think there are parents of all stripes who are saying that the culture seems to be encroaching in ways that they feel are just ubiquitous and they can't get around it, and they think that they really don't have a choice. They can't say to their kids, no, I don't want a computer in the bedroom, or, you know, no, we're not going to watch that sort of television show at our house, because they feel like everybody's doing it and they have no control. And so when I'm talking about this message, I'm saying, you know, you do. You can make choices. And parenting is not meant to be easy and simple. And, you know, kids aren't, you know, I don't think our job personally is to make sure our kids are happy at every moment. Our job is to make sure that we're safeguarding them and raising them up to have a value system that we feel is right for them. And so, you know, if we're letting the culture do it all for us and we're not necessarily standing up, even when we object to what we're seeing, then I think we're not really stepping up to the plate and doing the parenting job that we ought to be doing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about bringing up the kids not to be cool, but to be good, rounded, grounded. My guest, mother of four and family columnist Mary Beth Hicks, is with me in the studio today. She's author of the new book, Bringing Up Geeks, that is genuine, enthusiastic, empowered kids, how to protect your kids' childhood in a grow-up-too-fast world. Do people assume, you know, hearing your title, reading the book, that you're the uber-strict parent with Amish kids?
There is a bit of that. There is a bit of an assumption, I think, that you know, that if I'm advocating this sort of upbringing, if I want to shelter my kids a little bit from the media, that I must be raising them to be, you know, completely in a cave, you know, which is silly. It's just silly. In fact, one of the things I advocate in the book is that we parents need to take a stronger stand and have a little more authority in the home, exhibit the authority that we really ought to be having over our kids. And when you have a home with a proper authority structure where children understand that mom and dad are in charge and they can't always call all the shots, we have very little conflict in my home. We just do things differently than maybe other people do, and our kids understand that that's the culture in our house. And so it's a very it's a happy environment. We don't have a lot of conflict over a lot of these decisions. Sometimes they don't really love some of the things we'll say and or decisions we make, and they'll object to it, but they do it respectfully. And, you know, we don't allow a lot of door slamming and yelling, I hate you. It just doesn't go with the way that we're raising kids. And so when they object to some of the rules we may have, we'll say, well, you know, we appreciate that that's how you feel, but this is what we feel like we have to do to be doing what's best for you.
What's the picture you want to avoid? What's the sort of profile of the child that you're trying not to have your children become?
Okay. The kids who wear the T-shirts that say spoiled brat and talk back to their parents, and that you hear them in the store or a restaurant or something, and I've been in places where I've heard parents treated so disrespectfully by kids who are so spoiled and so, you know, have such expectations that the world revolves around them, that I feel like the parents, I want to sit there and say to the parents, do you have any self-respect whatsoever? Why would you let your child talk to you that way? And so that's a piece of this, is that notion that these kids, we're raising almost a generation of narcissistic children who expect everything to be handed to them and who really think that there are no limits for them. And that's what I'm trying to avoid.
Let's get a call in here. We've got lots of people who want to join you, Mary Beth Hicks. Emma calling from Groton, Connecticut. Emma, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi, Emma.
Hi. I am finding everything you say to be exactly what my husband and I have been thinking, that our children are younger. They're mm-hmm. 5, 3, and 1. But I've already noticed that even at that younger age, we're limiting more than some other parents. And I think that as parents in this day and age, we're kind of scared of what the other parents will think of us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even at the age of 4, my children weren't allowed to watch Jurassic Park with their 5-year-old friends, and the 5-year-old friends couldn't figure out why.
Sure. Oh, boy, I've been there. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm finding everything you say to be where we're headed, I think, to the point where I've realized that, like you said, cool is not the goal of parenthood, absolutely, to the point where we're going to be homeschooling this fall for kindergarten.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of people are choosing that because it feels like the safest place to be. I can understand that.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, I don't want to shelter them completely, like you said. Mm-hmm. I want them to be part of society, but I want them to be the better part of society.
So. Well, I do appreciate that when you're parenting in this way, Emma, you often feel alone. You have to take a stand at times when other parents are doing things that you just can't understand. But I think in my experience, and I, you know, when my kids were younger and I was in the same boat where you are, I just would simply be very unabashed about it, not judging others, but simply say, you know what, that's not right for us. You know, that's not what we want to do. That's not a movie I want my kids to see right now and maybe down the road. And if you just present it in that way, here's what I discovered as my kids got older. I was the domino mom. So what happened is I would say no, and then other parents, because they wanted to say no, but it was too difficult to turn their kids down, would go, oh, well, the Hickses aren't doing it, so I guess we won't either. And suddenly I was the one kind of leading the pack in some of those decisions, and that was fine too. You know, if that was what it took for those parents to take that same stand, I had no problem with it. But you will find that you might have to be the courageous parent in your crowd in many occasions, but stick with it because it's worth it.
Emma, thanks for your call. Here are some of the rules from Mary Beth Hicks for raising geeks, bringing up geeks. She says, raise a brainiac, raise a sheltered kid, raise an uncommon kid, raise a kid adults like, raise a late bloomer, raise a team player, raise a true friend, a homebody, a principled kid, a faithful kid. We'll look at some of those. I want to expand the conversation, if I may. Joining us right now from New York is Stephanie Ilgenfritz. She is deputy editor of the Personal Journal section at the Wall Street Journal. She contributes to the journal's Juggle blog. It's an online section devoted to family and work life. She has two kids of her own, ages 9 and 11. Stephanie, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hi there. Thanks
for
having me on.
It's great to have you. You hear what Mary Beth is up to here with her four kids. She wants to kind of pull them out of the media, some of the media culture, a big chunk of it maybe, pull them out of the fast track. She wants to protect their innocence, make them late bloomers, make them homebodies, make them genuine, enthusiastic, empowered kids, geeks in her words. What do you say, Stephanie?
Well, I think that she makes a lot of good points, and I think that we are not really very far apart in our approaches here. I laughed a little earlier in this segment. I was listening in, and you said, "Are we going to build our kids arcs and put them in there to protect them?" And I don't think that's quite what Mary Beth is saying, and I don't think that's what a lot of parents would advocate. Although some do, we get at the blog and letters that people write into us, we hear from parents who have all sorts of approaches, and some parents are so terrified of the media influences that they are keeping their children very, very sheltered, homeschooling, for instance, but beyond that, you know, really trying to keep them out of the mainstream of culture. And then other people obviously are at the other extreme, and I think most of us are somewhere in the middle. I would say I'm somewhere in the middle as well. I think there have to be limits, and the limits have to be age-appropriate. But they, at the same time, they do have to engage in society, and they have to be aware of the influences that are going to be increasingly surrounding them as they get older, and so that they can learn how to deal with them. And dealing with them together is sort of the approach that we have at our house, I would say.
But what about holding that line? I mean, where the line is drawn is what it's all about. You can have limits, but if they're when the kid is, 17 or 18, well, you may not be able to enforce them anyway, and they're practically gone. But when you try at age 10 and 11 in some communities these days to say no cell phone, no IM, no this or that movie, that can be pretty tough. Just that to hold the line on. Never mind no dating, no XYZ. Are you ready to pull the lines that tough and down that far, Stephanie?
We do have limits at our house. We don't have a lot of hard and fast rules. Very specific rules. I think overall we just have a disciplined household, and we try to give the children such a wide range of interests that they're not necessarily always that interested in some of the so-called cool things that they encounter at school and on TV. They might watch some of the shows like Hannah Montana that their friends watch, but they're not obsessed with it. They can put it in its place because they have so many other interests in life. I don't have to make a lot of rules about what they watch on TV because they have so many other things going on that their interest in it, I think, is appropriate. It's moderate. Probably the biggest thing we do at our house that keeps the kids very active and engaged socially, but not too obsessed with any one particular media influence, is sports. Our kids are really into sports, each into sports that are appropriate for their own personality and level of of their competitive nature, and that's one thing that works for us. But I don't necessarily make a lot of strict rules about what sorts of toys they can play with. Somebody gave us, I'll give you an example. Somebody gave us once, my daughter, who's now 11, when she was a little younger, a doll. It's called a Bratz doll. You might be familiar with it. It's a big-headed doll, and they're very sexy looking, and I don't like them, especially for very young girls. I think it's silly to make girls so interested in being sexy at such a young age. But I didn't tell her she couldn't have it. Somebody had given it to us. I wouldn't buy it, but I didn't tell her she had to give the toy back. But we talked about it, and she looked at it, and she pulled its head off and cut its hair, and it's in the bottom of the closet. And then she went back to soccer, you know. And so she naturally was able to deal with it with guidance from me, and I didn't have to make a strict rule against it in order for her to figure out that it wasn't for her.
Not cool to be cool, say Stephanie Ilgenfritz and Mary Beth Hicks. Let me go to our listeners, Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi. I am raising a 12-year-old boy, and I have a story of the value of parents and adults saying no and asserting authority. I grew up in Greenville, South Carolina, in the northwestern corner of the state, and there were fraternities and sororities at age sixth grade.
In high school, middle school, elementary?
Rush. Wow. No, this would be middle school.
Okay.
I don't know if this was, I guess, back in the 70s. And actually, weekly meetings at little girls' houses that, you know, moms would drive you there, and you had dues, and you had rush, and then after rush, you actually had hazing. No one was beating me, but I couldn't wash my hair for 3 weeks. Went to school with, you know, dirty hair, greasy hair, and I remember wearing a peacock suit to school.
What's a peacock suit? You mean really dressed like a peacock, or just primped up?
I had blue shoes that were curly at the toes, and I had all I remember is the shoes.
So all this was to be cool, Elizabeth, and be part of the sorority.
Was, you know, just kind of humiliate you. This is Rush. This is what happens to the newbies. And in addition to that, I ran around some girl's house. They put a banana in my pants. Actually, it's on my underwear, touching my skin.
Oh, well.
With steak, and I had to.
I don't know where we're going here. What have you taken from that in your own child rearing, Elizabeth?
I wish that the principal of my school and the teachers said, no, not in my classroom. Go. I'm sending you home. I'm sending you home, and I wish the parents had said, no way are we allowing little girls in sixth and seventh and eighth grade, and actually. Was there in high school as well. You're just too young for this.
To have rush for sorority and all the peer pressure that came along with that. Mary Beth Hicks, that sounds kind of extreme and particular to a time and place, but is there still that kind of peer pressure to be cool, primp up?
Yep. It is. Certainly her story is particular to time and place. And really, fascinating memories. I'm sure they definitely play a role in how you parent, Elizabeth, because you don't want to repeat those things for your children. However, girl world is still a very competitive and can be a very cutthroat place. And even some of that sort of relational aggression that she experienced in that environment is very much a part of the cool, popular crowd today. In fact, as I wrote the book, I did find a study that said that sort of what we sort of maybe knew intuitively growing up, which is that the cool people are the ones who are perpetrating that relational aggression, what we used to just call nastiness, which now has a nice title for it, that's really true, that the kids who are perceived as more popular are also perceived as being meaner. They're not the same kids who are the bullies. They're the ones who are the popular ones are the ones egging on the bullies. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic, but it's really true that popularity, and that's just one piece of it, popularity in and of itself is a predictor for deviant behavior as well. So kids who self-identify or who are identified by their peers as being the most popular in their group, in their class, are also the ones who are at highest risk for drinking, drug use, adolescent sex, all kinds of deviancy. So
you say, but you also describe a whole bunch of parents who actually want their kids to be popular, cool, who push and support them in that. Mm-hmm. Is this where the battle line is drawn between parents? I mean,
I hate to do that because I really don't. That's not my goal in the book is not to create a caste warfare among, you know, the popular and the uncool at school. Okay, but we all know that those caste systems literally exist in the school environment. environment. And so there are parents who are feeding it, promoting it for whatever their own reasons. Either they were popular as kids or they weren't. They want their kids to be popular, and they facilitate the access to media and the materialism that makes sure that that's a possibility for their child. And so I have to say we need to look at what our role is with our kids and decide how important is their social prominence to us. Is that a reflection of our success or of our popularity among our own peers? And we have to look at that and say, is that really in the best interest of our kid?
Stephanie, does this kind of geek childhood, as Mary Beth defines it, does it have to come at the cost of popularity, of social status in childhood, in high school? Is that a good thing if it does?
Popularity and social status are interesting words that can be kind of hard to define. I actually asked my daughter, who by all accounts is actually popular at school, is well-liked, but I asked her, what is cool at school? And she had a hard time answering it. And I have heard her many times refer to a group of girls at school that she says are what is known as the popular ones, mm-hmm. and they are what she and her friends call the girly girls, that, I guess, dress in clothes that make them look older and try to get the attention of boys, that sort of thing, as she describes it. And she said that, really, they're not that popular, and they convince themselves and their little group that they are popular, and their parents maybe allow them to behave this way, the idea that that's how popular should be defined. But most of the kids have so many other interests in life, and my daughter and her friends are into sports, and they're reading, and they like to go to the library and talk about books and do their sports, and they're not interested in that, and they don't feel that they're not popular, really. They don't feel that they're not cool. They don't feel they're not well-liked because they don't adhere to that sort of narrow traditional definition of what's cool.
So it depends how you define it. Let's get a call from Chelsea in Boston. Hi, Chelsea. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Okay. I'm 23. I just graduated high school 5 years ago.
Okay.
And I was lucky. My parents raised me. We watched the Discovery Channel. We watched TLC. Going to the museum was a regular thing, not a once a year, let's teach the kids something. And I remember being in high school and looking at the girls who wore shirts with the total princess or spoiled brat, like Mary Beth was talking about, and thinking, don't they realize how stupid they look, how insipid they sound, how vapid they're presenting themselves? Do they really want to be that way?
So maybe you were a geek, at least as she defines it, and it sounds, Chelsea, as though you're glad for that. At 23, how do you look back on it?
I'm thrilled. I listen to NPR on my way to work. I am so happy about it. Now, the only thing I disagree with Mary Beth on is when she uses the term sheltered, but when Stephanie was on, she was talking about how, you know, she let her daughter make the decision for herself about the brat. So that's how my parents were. I could see most things that I wanted. I mean, you know, I wasn't allowed to watch Jurassic Park when it was in the theaters. But, you know, my mom would talk to me about it and say, well, you know, yes, you can have that doll, but it looks like this, and this is the image it's presenting, and she let me make the decision myself. And the arguments that we had when I was a teenager, I mean, don't get me wrong, we fought. I was a teenager. That's supposed to happen.
Mm.
But it was about whether or not I could go to rehearsal when I was in theater or do my homework, not whether or not I could go to a party.
Mary Beth, is this the voice in Chelsea of your ideal geek?
She is my poster girl, Chelsea. You're what I'm working for, and I hope that my daughters, who are older teenagers, sound as self-possessed and self-confident and as bright and articulate as you. I would argue that some teenagers don't know what the word insipid means, honey, so that might be why they didn't know about those T-shirts. But my point is this, when I use the word sheltered, back when Katie was my oldest, and I talk about her a lot because she's the oldest, she's sort of your teacher, it's not a favoritism thing. But I remember when she was in the sixth grade, kids were talking at lunch about their favorite MTV music videos. And we didn't allow MTV in our house. So she piped up with a story about one of her favorite music videos, which was on Disney. And a couple of the kids started snickering. And one of the girls said to her, "You are so sheltered." And Katie came home and she was horrified. "Someone called me sheltered." And I said, "Here's the thing. Shelter is a safe place where we keep you safe from the elements. And that's what we're doing here."
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about bringing up the kids not to be cool, but to be good, rounded, grounded. My guest, a mother of four and family columnist for The Washington Times, is Mary Beth Hicks. Her new book is Bringing Up geeks, that is, genuine, enthusiastic, empowered kids, how to protect your kids' childhood in a grow-up, too-fast world. Stephanie Ilgenfritz is with us as well. She's deputy editor of the Personal Journal section at the Wall Street Journal and writes for the Juggle blog, devoted to family and work life there, has two kids of her own. You know, Stephanie, Mary Beth, in a way, you both make it sound easy. I don't think it's easy. I mean, that media, that culture you're talking about is all over the place. Turn on any television, any radio, any music station. I mean, I don't know about this degree of sheltering. Maybe it's not an arc, but it's going to be something close to an arc, it seems to me, to hold out the volume of stuff that you're describing as holding out.
I don't think it's always easy, but I would agree with Stephanie's point earlier, and that is that it's not just saying no to things, it's also putting other things in your life that where you say yes. So as she described, my kids are avid readers, they're athletic, they're all into sports, they're all into volunteerism in some capacity, they're very busy kids. They're not as engaged with some of the pop culture because they are engaged with other things. And so that's a big piece of it for us. As well, you know, some of it's not difficult because it's simply the way we do things at our house. We have standards about manners, for example. We have a specific way in which our kids answer the telephone even. You know, they say Hicks residence, so-and-so speaking. You know, it's polite, it's courteous. And so we have some things that we do at our house that are just standard operating procedures. So we don't spend a lot of time talking about the rules. To be honest with you, with four children, I'd have a hard time remembering a lot of rules. I wouldn't even remember what I was supposed to know in terms of. So it's more of policies. It's policies about the way we operate our home. And when we're the adults and we're the authority figures in the home, we implement our vision of our family, and it reflects our values, and it's really more simple than that. Now, yes, it's really tough to hold the culture at bay in some ways, and as I said earlier, we're not doing it in such a way that we live in a bubble, but our kids know that at least in our home, for example, we regulate the sorts of shows we watch on TV, and that's not that difficult to do.
Stephanie, can you do that these days without coming off to your children, to their friends, as a kind of parent tyrant?
Well, I agree with Mary Beth. It isn't easy, and it really has to do very broadly with how you live your life and the overall example that you give. You know, the behavior that you model for the children goes a long way toward making sure that they can help. You know, as they get older, make some of these decisions themselves. But it isn't easy. There are a lot of other influences out there. Even I have a son who's 9, and there are influences on him as well. There's a song that some of the other kids at school sing a lot, and they don't understand the lyrics because the lyrics are not articulated well by the singers. But I looked up the lyrics online, and I don't like the lyrics, so I did have to sort of draw the line and say you can't sing that song.
But yet your son knows it if he sang it.
But he does. He goes during the parts that are crude because he doesn't actually understand the words. And I didn't tell him what the words are. I know what they are. I won't say them on the air.
You have to do that, though. You have to go to lyrics.com to find the words, don't you, Stephanie? And then you have to go to urbandictionary.com sometimes to figure out what they mean.
Well, mm-hmm. I knew what it meant. He wouldn't if I explained it to him. And it's not something that he's old enough to understand or should be.
But that ocean of culture is so big.
Yeah,
I mean, you're going to.
I told him that he couldn't sing the song anymore.
Right. But if you're going to Urban Dictionary to figure out what pop music is, and pop music is all over the mm-hmm. place. I mean, are you raising kids who, once it does wash over them, and it will mm-hmm. in this country, in our culture, they're kind of somehow more vulnerable to it. Is there some advantage in some inoculation here, some exposure, some interaction with that culture so they're not afraid of it, they're not overwhelmed by it, they know it's there, they may know darn well what all the words are,
right.
But you're teaching them in that case some kind of balance in the storm if it's a
right.
storm.
Because
there's
a big difference between ignorance and innocence,
mm-hmm.
and I do not want ignorant children.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know what the culture is, I know what the words mean, I know what the songs are, and that's how, first of all, I decipher whether it's appropriate for my children. That's I can't be discerning if I don't even know myself. It's important that our kids don't feel that they have a lot of information and savvy and worldly wise knowledge that we don't have. In fact, my kids know that I'm pretty in the know. That's why I seem cool to their friends, which is hilarious. But the fact is that you can't know to say no if you don't even know what's out there. So it's incumbent on us to know what the media is putting in front of our kids and what those messages are. But I think it's also harmful to a child to hand them an iPod and let them fill it with all kinds of stuff that has lyrics in it that are misogynistic or violent or antisocial, and we're just humming along because it's got a great beat. You know, there's more to life than just tapping your foot. And
abdication,
I think we need to know.
And off you go. Let's go to Jacob in Newport, Rhode Island. Jacob, what do you know, my friend?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I was my parents raised me pretty well as a geek, I like to think. I turn out this way, but, you know, my parents always gave me sort of the intellectual toys, and not a lot of the other just kind of play around with toys. And I grew up in a white toast town in Connecticut, down on the shoreline. Mm. And, you know, my parents keeping me fairly sheltered ended up, through middle school, turning into a rather traumatic experience. Whether this was because my parents were never really athletic and didn't really push me towards athletics, when everyone else was trying to figure out what they're trying to do, my parents resailed, I figured that out. But I was victim to a lot of teasing because I didn't do a lot of the mainstream things. I wasn't listening to mainstream music. And that led to a very traumatic experience, especially in sixth grade and seventh grade. And once things started smoothing out in eighth grade a little bit, and nothing really got that much better until I changed school districts, went to a magnet-type alternative school where there were a lot more geeks around for me to hang out with.
So how do you look back on it, Jacob? Was it worth it, or do you think it was a mistake in some way on your parents' part to raise you with that sheltered?
In hindsight, I am 100% appreciative to my parents. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love my mom. She's probably listening right now going, what? But, you know, and... I'm completely appreciative of what they did at the time.
But there was a cost, you're saying, and it hurt at the time.
It hurt at the time, and I think there is that expense, you know, that expense to be paid. For me, was it worth it? Yes. Had sixth grade been any worse, would it have been worth it? No.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Jacob, thanks. Mary Beth Hicks, here's a kind of a get real response from someone who's grateful for that path, and yet there were real costs involved with it that caused real pain that really hurt in experiencing them in sixth grade in this case.
Right. And lots of studies tell us right now that middle school years, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, are the most difficult for kids growing up emotionally. However, what I would argue is that here's who struggles in middle school. Everybody. Everybody struggles.
Not everyone is ostracized. Kids. Not everyone is deeply teased. Not everybody feels...
No. 90% of kids report they feel they have experienced bullying. That's a study that is quoted in the book. And I will say this. You want to be teased? Try being the chubby girl in the popular crowd in the next dressing room at Abercrombie who can hear her friend snickering about her because she gets the big size jeans.
And your answer is don't be at Abercrombie.
No, my answer is don't fool yourself into thinking that because kids appear to be cool and popular and socially prominent that they're not suffering. Every kid suffers as they grow. And we all, you know... Kids who are geeks may feel that they're not included or they're teased, and kids who are in the popular crowd are always jockeying for position and trying to hold on to their social status and sometimes compromising their values in order to be included by their own friends. It's a very tough time to grow up.
And I think you're discounting what Jacob is telling us a little bit lightly here.
No, I don't think so. I've had a son who went through the seventh grade from hell. Not at all. And absolutely, if he can look back and still say that he thanks his parents for the way that he was raised, you know, he definitely got that it was a tough time. And I can tell you as a parent, we parents watch our kids go through some of this stuff and we grieve. It's very hard to watch, but we can't protect our kids from every hurt that comes along. And that doesn't mean that I should sacrifice what I think is valuable for my child just so that I can assure his social status and that maybe he won't be teased. That's not going to happen.
Stephanie, what about the price of going against the tide a little bit or a lot? Are you always convinced it's worth it? Or, you know, can you sort of cinch up the harness so tight that your child pays too much of a price?
It is tough to figure out where to draw that line. You know, I try not to draw too many hard lines because they're going to get broken. But you need to struggle to find the balance between keeping your children safe and protected and isolating them so much that they are overwhelmed by the world around them as they encounter it more and more. So you do need to find a way, and I think Mary Beth and I are actually not far apart on this at all. They need to be part of the world and aware of it and understand it so that it doesn't overwhelm them, but they need to know where to say no, and they need help from us on where to say no.
Let's go to Marie in Providence, Rhode Island. Marie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have six-year-old identical twin daughters who couldn't be more different. One of them is a budding geek. She likes to refer to herself as a tomboy. And the other one would love to be a brat, if she could. And we're trying to raise them without this sort of closed loop of media that that I sense is coming as they get older. And it's it's a challenge. I'm just wondering what your guest take on these kids who supposedly have the same genetic structure.
Right. And one looks like she's headed for the geek path, maybe, and the other maybe a glitter girl.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Stick with us for a second, Marie. Mary Beth, what do you say?
Oh, I think it's wonderful in some ways, Marie, because every child wants to be unique, and it sounds like maybe your twins are finding their own place in the family where they can be individually themselves, and that's a big piece of what I'm talking about is raising geeks, is finding a child's individuality and really honoring that and nurturing it. I do think that trying to find their own way, you know, they can look very different and still be geeks, I guess I would put it that way, in that the geek lifestyle that I'm advocating has more to do with the overall lifestyle that you have in your home, the tone that you set for your kids. And within that, you can have a child who's very artistic or very feminine or very girly, as you'd put it, and one who's very athletic and one who, you know, is a tomboy. But what I'm talking about is the interior life of the child, that, you know, the values that they hold and the way that they behave and toward you and toward others is really what's going to be the mark of the geek.
I guess I'm wondering if implicit in your advice here, Mary Beth Hicks, is a kind of critique of the majority of American children. You're presenting this as the exceptional path, as the different path, as the path against the tide. Mm-hmm. Does that mean you're saying that you think most American kids are spoiled, messed up, in a problem state of mind?
Well, if you look at the news, it feels that way sometimes. But when I'm out in the world talking to people, I feel that it's much more the common ground of parenting is what I'm talking about. And yet, I do feel like parents feel that they need encouragement, they need justification sometimes, they need to be told, no, if you're saying no, that's an okay thing to do. Because the tide of, A, begging on the part of our kids, and B, the overall messages through the media that are telling us that this is what's, you know, this is part of life and you have to take it and accept it, you know, parents are feeling like, you know, this doesn't feel right to me, but I don't know what else to do. And part of it is just articulating this, having this conversation, listening to these callers call in and say, yeah, this is what I'm trying to do, but I feel like I'm all alone. Well, you know what? If I do nothing else but promote the notion that we're not alone and this is an okay way to parent and we can just feel comfortable in it, then I'd achieve my mission.
Stephanie, what do you think? Is the child rearing sort of center of gravity off base somehow? Would you agree?
I think I generally agree with what Mary Beth is saying. I'm not one that necessarily feels we're in some horrible, overwhelming crisis in the family in America, and that childhood has been destroyed by the media. I think that when I look around at the families that I know and the other children I know, everybody does things a little differently, but the children are well behaved and they're nice kids, and I'm happy for my children to play with them, and the families are nice to be with, and I don't feel that we're all as far apart as perhaps we think we are. And there's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy in here, as the media perhaps tells us that sends images that we think are frightening, and then it tells us that those images are frightening us, it can start to build on itself. And as a member of the media, I understand exactly how that can happen. But I think when you get down to it, we're not really necessarily all that far apart. And if parents feel isolated, perhaps conversations like this can go a long way toward reassuring us that we're all not really that far off.
Let me get one more call here from Sumter, South Carolina. Brian, you're on the air, Brian.
Hey, Tom, it's Brian. You know, I just really agree and appreciate the viewpoint that these ladies are bringing out. Because, you know, one of the things that I feel like that aren't happening is that parents are really not setting forth and deciding what is their goal for their child's childhood. You know, I mean, is my goal to raise a successful child, and I have four, or is my goal to raise a successful adult? Because the reality is that all childhood has its bumps and downs, and if we're not intentional about how we choose to define our children's culture, then it is the media that is going to define that culture for our children. And so what I'm really, you know, so I mean, we have to be intentional about how it is that we're going to go about and do it. And, you know, there's different ways that families do that. One of the things that we literally do every year is we sit down and as a family review, as the parents, what are the goals that we have set forth for our children? What are our educational goals for them? Irregardless of where they go to school or how they're schooled, what is my goal as their parent for that child? What is my goal for them spiritually, physically, emotionally? And sit down, and just doing that is a phenomenal process of predetermining and pre-establishing how it is that we as a family are going to function.
Brian, our time grows short, but you put a great word on the table here, intentionality. And Mary Beth Hicks, it seems to line up with a lot of what you're writing about. Many ways to go, but not just to sort of cut loose and float in our culture today. A sense of intention behind what parents do.
We need to stop being cheap and just go where everybody's going. We need to stop and think about what's best for our children and our families, and that's a big piece of it. It's something I talk about in the book, that I think that we need to be more thoughtful as parents and really say, you know, just as we did in that early instant messaging decision, it's, you know, insignificant as I thought it was. Well, is this right for us or is it not? Just because everybody else is doing it doesn't make it right for us. And that's just a small example of the sort of lifestyle that I'm really asking people to consider. And sometimes that will mean parenting in a way that is probably a little more courageous or at least a little out of the box. But I definitely think that there's, you know, our kids deserve our best effort as far as that goes. And if that means we just always look at those decisions and they add up to a lifestyle for ourselves and our families.
Mary Beth Hicks' new book is Bringing Up Geeks, How to Protect Your Kids' Childhood in a Grow Up Too Fast World. Stephanie Ilgenfritz, your kids, 9 and 11, you're headed right into the storm here. Are you braced? Are you ready?
Well, I think we're hopefully laying the groundwork so it won't be a complete nightmare.
let's cross fingers and hope it'll be fantastic. Stephanie Ilgenfritz of The Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Check it out. New website up today. Enjoy it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.